volume 2, page 600. And also Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that, talking about Dhul-Faqar, he says it was a sword brought by Jibreel from the heaven. And وَهُوَ الَّذِي نَادَى بِهِ مُنَادًا مِنَ السَّمَاءِ. This is the very sword regarding which a caller from the heaven said, لَا سَيْفَ إِلَّا ذُلْفَقَارِ وَلَا فَتَى إِلَّا عَلِيٍ. This is in Ilal al-Shara'i, volume 1, page 160. There are some other narrations. For example, Abu Rafa says that we heard a lot from the companions of the Prophet that on the day of Uhud, a caller said, لَا سَيْفَ إِلَّا ذُلْفَقَارِ وَلَا فَتَى إِلَّا عَلِيٍ, and many other narrations. This is mentioned both in Shia and Sunni sources. For example, when it comes to Sunni sources, I may refer to the commentary of Nahj al-Balagha by the famous Sunni scholar Ibn Abi al-Hadid, volume 14, page 251. So this is one of the cases in which people heard a call from the heaven. And there are some other examples for it, which I think we need to share in the following session.
May Allah actually make us among those who do not wake up with this heavenly call, but who wake up much more before that, and maybe proceed towards our Imam very early before having any miraculous call from the heaven. And whenever we hear this call, may Allah... Allah's mercy be on us. May we not be among those who get humiliated hearing this call. Inshallah. Thank you so much for hearing, and thank you so much for listening to us. In case you want to listen to our program again, go back to our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/en. You can go to the tab COI Call of Islam. There's an archive of our programs there. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest rose? Please, oh please, please come.
Population challenge.
Part 2.
Seoul, Gangnam District. The streets are dotted with high-rises and congested shopping malls. The streets receive visitors from all across South Korea. But the upscale and famous district is frequented by a special group of women more than any other group. The women go to Gangnam not just for taking a walk or shopping, but for something more important that is supposed to change their own and their family's destiny.
According to data from the Ministry of Health and Welfare, postpartum care centers in Korea, the first one actually began appearing around 1996 to reach nearly 300 10 years later. And as of last year, there were 510 such centers here in Korea. And on average, about a third, nearly 32% of new mothers in Korea do use the service.
The postpartum care centers in the country do what was called sanhejuri in the past. It was a tradition that belonged to the old Korea to take care of mothers and their children. It took between a week and a month. During this period, women would go to their parents' houses to eat healthy food in order to regain their strength. The centuries-old tradition faced radical changes in the mid-90s. Although some ethnic minorities and rural families were allowed to have two children, things weren't satisfactory for other people. The government made birth control and abortion widespread among the citizens. The violators faced harsh punishments. One-child policy was not just a recommendation. Confiscating property, tough penalties, sending the second and third children to nurseries, and mandatory sterilization were the punishments for those who did not follow one-child policy. The 1.4 billion strong population in China is larger than the population of entire Africa, a vast continent which is in a different situation compared to China. According to predictions, Africa's population will increase to 4.3 billion people in 2100 from the current 1.3 billion. At that time, the population growth in other parts of the planet will be zero. Nigeria will potentially witness a higher growth compared to its neighboring countries. The country, which has a population of a little over 200 million people, is predicted to become the third country with the largest population, with 400 million people in 30 years. Despite poverty and health issues, the Africans have a great tendency to have more children, but advanced countries like China and South Korea with way better economic situation are not willing to have children. Comparing the two cases have posed a new challenge to experts. Can we still claim that there is a direct link between poverty and declining population? In 1955, Denmark had a population growth rate of 2.5 for every woman, a little above the natural 2.1%. But today, the rate has fallen to 1.7%. The Danish population's average age during this period has increased from 32 to 41. It doesn't seem that policies to promote fertility have been successful. For years, having children isn't considered a value for Danish parents. Free education, equal payments, and social welfare didn't lead to expansion of families. Goals of life have changed. The new generation in the country prefers to allocate most of their time to themselves, experience the entertainment they like, or pursue the career they want. But the problem isn't the incompatibility between being a parent or employed. The change in view in giving birth to children might have other reasons as well.
I think it's not a need for women anymore. We don't need to have children. We find that our own happiness is more important, our own mental health is more important.
We have been called selfish. We've been called narcissists, which is kind of strange.
In middle school, one of my friends, she said she never had the desire to have kids, and she said that, and I was like, I didn't realize that that was an option. And when she said that, I was like, I don't know if I want to have kids either.
Just like other countries, Denmark is exposed to environmental threats. In the middle of all this, environmental activists raised the issue of both climate change and fertility rate. Some of them believe that bringing new children is a move against the planet. In fact, the birth of a new baby means more consumption, more carbon emission, and climate change. They claim giving birth to new children causes more destruction of the earth while we are grappling with the current crisis. So, in order to have a clean earth, we shouldn't give birth to more children. The view that has caused a heated controversy has other aspects as well. Today, every American citizen uses 12,000 watts of energy. Every Dutch citizen uses 8,000 watts. Every Swiss citizen uses 5,000 watts. And every Bangladeshi citizen uses 300 watts. According to a study in 1998, the citizens on Earth are allowed to use only 2,000 watts of power. In other words, American citizens pollute the earth 6 times more, Dutch citizens 4 times more, and Swiss citizens 2.5 times more than the average, while Bangladeshi citizens are 1,700 watts away from polluting the earth. It seems the consumerist lifestyle in developed countries is a more important factor in increasing the pollution. Birth control might be one of the strategies to tackle environmental challenges, but definitely it isn't the first or only strategy. Revision in using automobiles, changing industrial infrastructure, and changing consumption patterns might work more effectively in reducing pollutants. Even paying more attention to the hidden damage the pet industry incurs on the environment, who have replaced children in some cases. In addition, children in the future might be the people who will find more creative ways to resolve climate change issues. The obsession to have more children isn't limited to Denmark only. Manhattan in New York, with 1.5 million population, and its high-rises is one of the places that have drawn the attention of population experts. Over 50% of the densely populated region is single. The figure foretells an unexpected incident in the U.S. It seems living in urban areas and not having any children have a strange correlation in the country. Family-oriented areas are on the outskirts of cities while metropolises are characterized by people who are not willing to have children. In a borough like Manhattan, children are considered more of a nuisance than divine blessings. The high costs of living in cities and substandard social services have been determining factors in falling fertility rates, but these are not the only reasons. The rate of single women in the US has increased by 18%. It might be one of the consequences of the social movements like the sexual revolution in the 1960s. The increase didn't happen in half a century. But in just between 2000 and 2010, the change in lifestyle might be more determining than other factors to discourage Americans to have more children.
You can add Miley Cyrus to the growing number of millennials who won't have kids because of climate change.
Nowadays, it isn't that unusual that fans advocate celebrities' views against having birth to babies. Celebrities like Jennifer Aniston believe that her value as a woman isn't measured by motherhood. Benjamin Franklin, one of the founders of the U.S., in one of his articles in 1751 wrote that the population will increase twofold every 20 years. But Franklin wouldn't imagine that falling population rate will become an issue raised by the media because of abortion.
Good evening. In a landmark ruling, the Supreme Court today legalized abortions.
In 1973, the Supreme Court ruled that abortion in the U.S. is legal. The conflict between religious pro-life groups and advocates of abortion has been going on ever since. In 2011, 699,000 cases of abortion were registered in the country. As a result, the clashes between the opponents and proponents of the law intensified. The figures only include deliberate abortion, but there are cases of abortion that happen due to medical complications. This time around, environmental activists have gotten involved again, but from a different perspective. Phthalate is a chemical found in many plastic products used every day in the US and other countries. The mysterious chemical is absorbed in the consumer's bodies in the form of vapor or small particles. After a while, it causes a hidden disaster, hormonal disorder in endocrine glands, and negative effects on sexual organs are some of the detriments of the substance. If the embryos are lucky and can manage to overcome the phthalates, they will face the substance only twice, once in the womb, and the second time when they're drinking milk. Refusing to have children in the US, whether based on personal decision or infertility, has adversely affected replacement rate in the country. In 1960, a little before the sexual revolution, the replacement rate in the US was 3.6%. But during the next decades, it gradually diminished. The falling rates don't apply to some families, the majority of whom are religious. The number of children in Jewish, Muslim, and some traditional Christian families is remarkably more than the average in society. Besides, there are families with about 10 to 20 children who have stolen the limelight in the media. Yet, the replacement rate in the US is still moving in a downward slope. Until 2008, the diminishing rates didn't seem to be concerning, but the economic meltdown in that year worsened the situation. According to figures, today the replacement rate in the US is 1.7%. Some believe that the US owes even this figure to religious families who are inclined to have several children and the culture of migrants. Nowadays, most of the Americans ignore family values and are reluctant to start a family. The effect of immigrants on boosting the replacement rate isn't specific to the US. Germany is an interesting case regarding the role of immigrants in the country. For years, the population of Germany has been shrinking. The country's replacement rate has remained 1.4 for 40 years. So it isn't strange that 30% of women and 48% of German men say that they live a happier life without children. Germany is shrinking despite the fast entry of migrants to the country with a population of 83 million people. With the current trend of receiving the migrants, in 2040, every third person in Germany will be a migrant or born to migrant families. In the future, when migrants take up the jobs in the industrial country, the retired Germans will live in nursing homes. But the senior German citizens who live in the fourth largest economy in the world have better living conditions compared to their counterparts in the third largest economy, namely Japan. Since the 1990s, the population of people above 60 years old has been larger than those under 15. In 2000, the news broke that the body of a 69-year-old man who had died 3 years earlier was discovered in his house. The news reminded the Japanese that kodokushi will be their nightmare in their final years of life. Now, kodokushi, or lonely death, is a widespread phenomenon among the senile population in the country. Old people who have no children or are single, and the government has to pay their expenses. A Japanese statesman raised the alarm over the exorbitant prices in 2013. He said senior citizens had better hurry up to die. The distance from kodokushi to Sanhojuri and from the nursing homes in Tokyo to postpartum centers in Gangnam is too short. Life ends in one of them and starts in another. Although life starts under strange circumstances in those centers. Now those centers are affected by social classes. Austere centers with low levels of facilities are contrasted with luxurious centers with dreamlike services. The gap is yawning by the day. In this situation, Korean families are either reluctant to have children or are forced to accept the financial and emotional costs of having children. In this situation, replacing the population will fail. According to a report by South Korean Parliament, if the current trend persists, the South Korean population will be non-existent in 2750. It's a bitter destiny that might happen in other countries too. The incident shows infertility isn't just for economic, environmental, or biological reasons, but is the result of a change. A change in viewing life and finding a meaning for it.
Here at Arabi English Radio, congratulate all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of Eid al-Adha, the Feast of the Sacrifice. A happy Eid al-Adha to all of our listeners.
The Zionist regime's practices against Palestinian children include arresting them in the dead of night, arresting them without a court order and without explanation, handcuffing and blindfolding them, preventing their parents, family members, or lawyers from accompanying them, and subjecting them to beatings and insults. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote in this regard, in its latest attack on Gaza, the Zionist regime killed at least 33 Palestinians within 5 days, The attack was accompanied by calls from the Zionist regime's government ministers, including the overt fascists Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, for greater violence, in effect the intensification of genocide. Gaza has long been acquainted with the Zionist regime's policies of extermination. Yet, not a single action has been taken against the Zionist regime by any country nor by any Western democracy. The failure of the United Nations to hold the Zionist regime accountable for its crimes indicates complicity. That is precisely why Palestinian civil society issued its 2005 call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Such appeals are not addressed to the sanctimonious international community, but rather to solidarity groups and other civil society organizations around the world. Palestinians have advocated effective campaigning with the aim of compelling the fabricated regime of Israel to end its aggression against Gaza and the West Bank. The apartheid regime of Israel would not be able to commit all its war crimes against Palestinians in general, and Gazans in particular, without the full impunity offered by the international community. That is a glaring fact. It is unnecessary to remind the civilized world that the fabricated regime of Israel has mounted a continuous wave of attacks against the civilian population in Gaza. In September 2007, Gaza was declared an enemy entity. The Zionist regime prevented a wide range of food and basic materials from being imported into Gaza. It was even revealed that the Zionist regime's bureaucrats decided how many calories people in Gaza could consume. Fuel and electricity were cut too. Gaza has endured an electricity crisis for many years. The Zionist regime has turned Gaza into the largest concentration camp in the world. Its people have to dig tunnels so that they can bring fuel, medicine, and other necessities from Egypt into Gaza. True, we do hear words of sympathy from international community. One wonders what it will take to translate those words into action. Children killed in the early hours of the morning? Among the 7 children killed in Gaza recently were 4-year-old Hajar al-Bahtini and Ali, and Mayar Ezzedin, aged 8 and 12. U.S.-sourced warplanes were used to bomb their homes. Other children were orphaned. The dentist and hospital administrator Jamal Khaswan and his wife Mervat were killed, along with one of their sons. They leave behind 4 other children. To the Zionist regime, the children it killed were just collateral damage of its military onslaught, grotesquely named Operation Shield and Arrow. To justify the dehumanization of Palestinian children, Maurice Hirsch, who spent almost 2 decades in the Zionist regime's Military Advocate General Corps, tweeted that while the incidental loss of life of non-combatants is always unfortunate, the laws of war take into account that this is a possible and even legitimate result. And in much worse tweet, he goes further, considering the military advantage gained by eliminating these senior terrorists, it is irrelevant to ask how many children were incidentally killed. Hirsch's words encapsulate the Zionist ideology. Under the Zionist regime's genocidal, settler, colonial doctrine, the lives of the natives are irrelevant. Natives have to be eliminated so that white European colonizers, in this case Jewish supremacists, can flourish. According to the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights, everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and of his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services, and the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, or other lack of livelihood in circumstances beyond his control. Apparently, that right does not apply to the Palestinians. Such is the cruel logic of settler colonialism of the fabricated regime of Israel. Meanwhile, Arab News reported the Zionist regime security forces arrest about 1,000 Palestinian children from the streets, schools and homes of the West Bank each year, and about the same number from East Al-Quds on suspicion of involvement in attacks or protest. Children's rights organizations say such practices are abusive and harm youngsters' physical and mental health. They are prohibited by international laws and agreements related to the children's rights, to which the Zionist regime is a signatory. According to the organizations, the Zionist regime's practices against Palestinian children include arresting them in the dead of night, arresting them without a court order and without explanation, handcuffing and blindfolding them, preventing their parents, family members or lawyers from accompanying them and subjecting them to beatings and insults. The bodies say that children are exposed to physical pain and psychological pressure and go through experiences of loneliness, intense fear, confusion, humiliation, helplessness, and sometimes a sense of danger of death. They add that many children report severe post-traumatic symptoms following their release. Jessica Montel, executive director at Israel-based human rights organization Ha Moked, told Arab News, "Israel ignores its legal obligation to consider the child's best interest when it comes to Palestinian children wanted for interrogation. Traumatic night arrest remain the default method for bringing in Palestinian children." Ha Moked has petitioned the Israeli High Court against this practice. "We are demanding the Israeli military send a summons to parents when children are wanted for questioning." Adura Fares, director of the Palestinian Prisoners Club, told Arab News that the Zionist regime's military authorities 5 years ago introduced amendments to the law of military occupation in the West Bank and the civilian law in East Al-Quds to allow the arrest and trial of children aged 12 and upwards. Fares added that a series of alternative punishments have been adopted in East Al-Quds, such as fines, release on bail or house arrest, a 1 or 2 month in which the child's family deposits $6,000 with the court, and the amount is confiscated if the child leaves his home during the period of house arrest. Fares said house arrest for children is more difficult than ordinary imprisonment, as this method makes parents jailers for their children so they do not lose the money. Many children who are detained at home hate their parents, who have to ensure they remain imprisoned in the house until the end of the sentence, he said. A total of 160 Palestinian children are currently serving sentences in the Zionist regime prisons after being arrested for joining protests, raising the Palestinian flag or throwing stones. An Israeli settler shot dead a Palestinian recently. Ala Ghaysiyeh, 28, was killed in the settlement of Tana Umrim in Az-Zihriya, southwest of Al-Khalil. The shooting brought the number of Palestinians killed by the Zionist regime occupation forces and settlers since the beginning of the year to 157, including 36 in Gaza during May. The total includes 26 children. Four Palestinians were wounded by live bullets during clashes with the Zionist regime military forces, while settlers burnt five vehicles and 270 bales of straw between the villages of Tor Musaya and Al-Mughaber, east of Ramallah. The Zionist regime army has begun arresting members of the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine. The Zionist regime intelligence officers are texting PFLP members, warning them not to participate in activities of the organization. A former prisoner and member of the PFLP confirmed to Arab News that he had received a message adding that warnings had recently increased from the Zionist regime's intelligence agency, Shin Bet. It has been reported that more than 100 Palestinians affiliated with PFLP have been arrested in recent weeks.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray five times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, dini, wal-Azam, ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about some of the jurisprudential laws and Islamic laws about Hajj, but according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws about Hajj based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javed. Sheikh Javed, while performing Ramy or stoning, or before performing it, if it happens that a used stone, not a fresh one, falls into the container from which we, drawn or use some of the stones to throw at the pillars, right? If one of the used pebbles gets into the container by mistake and gets mixed up with the unknown ones, with the fresh ones, should we throw 8 stones while one of them is used?
Very good. Well, if he throws 8 stones, there is no problem because one of the stones is used. It will not be counted as a stone, as a stoning actually, because we are supposed to perform, we are supposed to throw 7 pebbles, not very big stones, pebbles at the pillars or at the devil. And if there are 8, then it does not affect the stoning or what they call ram. Mm-hmm. And in that case, one will be additional. There is no problem in throwing more stones at the pebbles to make sure that maybe out 7 out of those stones will hit the pebbles. The devils or the pillars. His Eminence also says that, okay, when you are sure you have performed ram stoning using new and unused stones, then it's valid, it's sufficient, and there's no problem in using an extra one.
Mm-hmm, I see.
Yes.
A person is able to perform ram or stoning on the 8 al-Adha. But in the afternoon, as there's no crowd at Jamara Aqaba at that time, can this person hire a representative for performing Ramy in the morning of 8? If he wants to perform Ramy in the afternoon, he would not be able to slaughter the animal on the day of 8. Can he hire a representative for Ramy so that he or they may slaughter the animal on the day of 8, though we can do it in the afternoon personally?
If a person is capable, of course, capable of performing Rami, which is translated as stoning.
Mm-hmm.
So Rami means stoning. If a person is himself capable of performing Rami, even in the afternoon, then of course hiring a representative is not valid. It's not in order to choose a proxy or to appoint a proxy for this purpose. But in the event that the one does not hope that the excuse he has may not be removed, maybe he has problems, he has physical problems, or maybe he has some excuses which are valid according to Sharia, and he does not hope that that excuse may be removed until the last moment of the day, then, of course, he may hire a representative. In that case, there would be no objection to him. Now, if by chance there a person's excuse is removed after performing the ritual, the right of the representative, the action which is done by the representative is sufficient, and it's not permissible to repeat it, nor is it compulsory to do any other act. So because that proxy did it on his behalf or on her behalf, usually women have problem, you know, approaching that area, because that area is highly crowded and people feel, you know, because of the stampede, because of the crowd, people feel scared to get close to those stones.
A few people sometimes get stuck and die on the stampede or on pressure.
Yes. If you hire a proxy and the proxy does his job accordingly, and then maybe the excuse is removed, you have no problem going there. It's not necessary to repeat what the proxy did on your behalf.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. This is me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And just with our guest speaker, we are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws about Hajj based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Just let me continue asking you the questions related to Hajj. You know, we all know that, you know, Jamara has been expanded recently. So having said that, if a part of the wall of Jamar Aqaba would be outside Mina, is performing Rami on that part valid, while the whole wall is considered as Jamar Aqaba?
It doesn't seem to be the walls that have been built, or the pillars that have been expanded. You know, each pillar could be as wide as 24 meters, and some of them are very joint walls. Now, if a pilgrim is certain that a part of the wall expanded is situated outside Mina, then on the basis of precaution, he should throw stones at the very part that is not outside Mina. So there is at least one part of the wall which is not outside of Mina. So he should aim at that part and hit that part of the pillar to make sure that he has or she has hit that part of the wall which is not outside of Mina.
I see. In light of this new expansion in Jamara, what's the duty of a person who does not know the real part? Or is it sufficient to stone at any part of this wall?
Well, if a person can perform stoning and can throw pebbles or stones at the actual place of the previous pillar without unbearable difficulty, without unbearable hardship, it is obligatory that he perform Ram at that very place, at that very part of the pillar. But if searching, if looking for that part, you know, constitutes a lot of hardship, and then pelting stone or throwing stones will result in unbearable difficulty, which is exempted actually according to Islamic Sharia, then it is sufficient to throw pebbles on any part of the wall, because Islam does not want a duty-bound person to go beyond what he can afford, beyond his obligations. So usually it is very difficult for a pilgrim to stone that pillar at that very specific part which used to stand there long time before, even in the early period of Islam. So nowadays, for the facility of the pilgrims, in order for the pilgrims to be comfortable, the Saudi authorities have actually expanded the pillars, the three pillars, to facilitate the stoning, to make it easy for the pilgrims to stone the pillars, so that the pilgrims,
the huge crowd, yes, can manage to, yes, throw stones, yeah, at any part.
Usually,
of the wall,
people,
right?
And a lot of all elderly people end up dying there because of the huge crowd or because of the stampede. So it's okay if that one should not go to extreme hardship or to that extent where he may risk his life.
Right.
If that is the case, then he is exempted. He should throw his stones at any part of the pillar.
Okay, thank you very much, Javed, for your nice comment and answering the questions related to Hajj based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Thank you very much for joining us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun Maljaa ilaha illahum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Samiun Basir La ilaha illahum وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.